Chapter 5. The dog cart, with Mr. Thomas Idle and his ankle on the hanging seat behind, Mr. Francis Goodchild and the innkeeper in front, and the rain in spouts and splashes everywhere, made the best of its way back to the little inn. The broken moor country looking like miles upon miles of pre-Adamite sop, or the ruins of some enormous jorum of antediluvian toast and water. The trees dripped, the eaves of the scattered cottages dripped, the barren stone walls dividing the land dripped, the yelping dogs dripped, carts and wagons under ill-roofed penthouses dripped. Melancholy cocks and hens perching on their shafts, or seeking shelter underneath them, dripped. Mr. Goodchild dripped, Thomas Idle dripped, the innkeeper dripped, the mare dripped, the vast curtains of mist and cloud passed before the shadowy forms of the hills, streamed water as they were drawn across the landscape. Down such steep pitches, that the mare seemed to be trotting on her head, and up such steep pitches, that she seemed to have a supplementary leg in her tail, the dog cart jolted and tilted back to the village. It was too wet for the women to look out. It was too wet even for the children to look out. All the doors and windows were closed, and the only sign of life or motion was in the rain-punctured puddles. Whiskey and oil to Thomas Idle's ankle, and whiskey without oil to Francis Goodchild's stomach, produced an agreeable change in the systems of both, soothing Mr. Idle's pain, which was sharp before, and sweetening Mr. Goodchild's temper, which was sweet before. Portmanteaus being then opened and clothes changed, Mr. Goodchild, through having no change of outer garments, but broadcloth and velvet, suddenly became a magnificent portent in the innkeeper's house, a shining frontispiece to the fashions for the month, and a frightful anomaly in the Cumberland village. Greatly ashamed of his splendid appearance, the conscious Goodchild quenched it as much as possible, in the shadow of Thomas Idle's ankle, and in a corner of the little covered carriage that started with them for Wigton, a most desirable carriage for any country, except for its having a flat roof and no sides, which caused the plumps of rain accumulating on the roof to play vigorous games of bagatelle into the interior all the way, and to score immensely. It was comfortable to see how the people coming back in open carts from Wigton Market made no more of the rain than if it were sunshine, how the Wigton policeman taking a country walk of half a dozen miles, apparently for pleasure, in resplendent uniform, accepted saturation as his normal state, how clerks and schoolmasters in black loitered along the road without umbrellas, getting varnished at every step, how the Cumberland girls, coming out to look after the Cumberland cows, shook the rain from their eyelashes and laughed it away, and how the rain continued to fall upon all, as it only does fall in hill countries. Wigton Market was over, and its bare booths were smoking with rain all down the street. Mr. Thomas Idle, melodramatically carried to the inn's first floor, and laid upon three chairs, he should have had the sofa, if there had been one. Mr. Goodchild went to the window, to take an observation of Wigton, and report what he saw to his disabled companion. "Brother Francis, Brother Francis," apostrophe cried Thomas Idle, "what do you see from the turret?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, I see, apostrophe," said Brother Francis, "what I hope and believe to be one of the most dismal places ever seen by eyes. I see the houses with their roofs of dull black, their stained fronts, and their dark-rimmed windows, looking as if they were all in mourning. As every little puff of wind comes down the street, I see a perfect train of rain let off along the wooden stalls, in the marketplace and exploded against me. I see a very big gas lamp in the center which I know, by a secret instinct, will not be lighted tonight. I see a pump, with a trivet underneath its spout whereon to stand the vessels, that are brought to be filled with water. I see a man come to pump, and he pumps very hard, but no water follows, and he strolls empty away. apostrophe, Brother Francis, Brother Francis, apostrophe, cried Thomas Idle, what more do you see from the turret, besides the man and the pump, and the trivet and the houses all in mourning and the rain? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I see, apostrophe, said Brother Francis, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, linen draper's shops in front of me. I see a linen draper's shop next door to the right, and there are 5 more linen draper's shops down the corner to the left. 11 homicidal linen draper's shops within a short stone's throw, each with its hands at the throats of all the rest. Over the small first floor of one of these linen draper's shops appears the wonderful inscription, Bank. Apostrophe, Brother Francis, Brother Francis, apostrophe, cried Thomas Idle, what more do you see from the turret, besides the 11 homicidal linen draper's shops, and the wonderful inscription, Bank, on the small first floor, and the man and the pump, and the trivet and the houses all in mourning and the rain? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I see, apostrophe, said Brother Francis, the depository for Christian knowledge, and through the dark vapor I think I again make out Mr. Spurgeon looming heavily. Her Majesty the Queen, God bless her, printed in colors, I am sure I see. I see the illustrated London News of several years ago, and I see a sweetmeat shop which the proprietor calls a salt warehouse with one small female child in a cotton bonnet looking in on tiptoe, oblivious of rain. And I see a watchmaker's with only 3 great pale watches of a dull metal hanging in his window, each in a separate pane. Apostrophe, Brother Francis, Brother Francis, apostrophe, cried Thomas Idle, what more do you see of Wigton, besides these objects, and the man and the pump, and the trivet and the houses all in mourning and the rain? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I see nothing more, apostrophe, said Brother Francis, and there is nothing more to see, except the curl-paper bill of the theater, which was opened and shut last week. The manager's family played all the parts, and the short, square, chinky omnibus that goes to the railway, and leads to rattling a life over the stones to hold together long. Oh yes. Now, I see 2 men with their hands in their pockets and their backs towards me. Apostrophe, Brother Francis, Brother Francis, apostrophe, cried Thomas Idle, what do you make out from the turret of the expression of the 2 men with their hands in their pockets and their backs towards you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, they are mysterious men, apostrophe, said Brother Francis, with inscrutable backs. They keep their backs towards me with persistency. If one turns an inch in any direction, the other turns an inch in the same direction, and no more. They turn very stiffly, on a very little pivot, in the middle of the marketplace. Their appearance is partly of a mining, partly of a plowing, partly of a stable character. They are looking at nothing very hard. Their backs are slouched, and their legs are curved with much standing about. Their pockets are loose and dog's-eared, on account of their hands being always in them. They stand to be rained upon, without any movement of impatience or dissatisfaction, and they keep so close together that an elbow of each jostles an elbow of the other, but they never speak. They spit at times, but speak not. I see it growing darker and darker, and still I see them, sole visible population of the place, standing to be rained upon with their backs towards me, and looking at nothing very hard. Apostrophe, Brother Francis, Brother Francis, apostrophe, cried Thomas Idle, before you draw down the blind of the turret, and come in to have your head scorched by the hot gas, see if you can, and impart to me, something of the expression of those 2 amazing men. Apostrophe, the murky shadows, apostrophe, said Francis Goodchild, are gathering fast, and the wings of evening, and the wings of coal, are folding over Wigton. Still, they look at nothing very hard, with their backs towards me. Ah! Now, they turn, and I see apostrophe, Brother Francis, Brother Francis, apostrophe, cried Thomas Idle, tell me quickly what you see of the 2 men of Wigton. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I see, apostrophe, said Francis Goodchild, that they have no expression at all. And now the town goes to sleep, undazzled by the large unlighted lamp in the marketplace, and let no man wake it. Apostrophe, at the close of the next day's journey, Mr. Thomas Idle's ankle became much swollen and inflamed. There are reasons which will presently explain themselves for not publicly indicating the exact direction in which that journey lay, or the place in which it ended. It was a long day's shaking of Thomas Idle over the rough roads, and a long day's getting out, and going on before the horses, and fagging up hills, and scouring down hills, on the part of Mr. Goodchild, who in the fatigues of such labors, congratulated himself on attaining a high point of idleness. It was at a little town, still in Cumberland, that they halted for the night, a very little town, with the purple and brown moor close upon its one street, a curious little ancient market cross set up in the midst of it, and the town itself looking much as if it were a collection of great stones piled on end by the Druids long ago, which a few recluse people had since hollowed out for habitations. Is there a doctor here? Apostrophe apostrophe asked Mr. Goodchild, on his knee, of the motherly landlady of the little inn, stopping in his examination of Mr. Idle's ankle, with the aid of a candle. Eh, my word! Apostrophe apostrophe said the landlady, glancing doubtfully at the ankle for herself. There's Dr. Speddy. Apostrophe, is he a good doctor? Apostrophe apostrophe, eh? Apostrophe apostrophe said the landlady, I circa him so. A cum's ether nay doctor that I can. Mare, nor which, a's just the doctor here. Apostrophe, do you think he is at home? Apostrophe apostrophe, her reply was, gang awa, jock, and bring him. Apostrophe, jock, a white-headed boy, who, under pretense of stirring up some basalt in a basin of water for the laving of this unfortunate ankle, had greatly enjoyed himself for the last 10 minutes in splashing the carpet, set off promptly. A very few minutes had elapsed, when he showed the doctor in, by tumbling against the door before him, and bursting it open with his head. Gently, jock, gently, apostrophe said the doctor as he advanced with a quiet step. Gentlemen, a good evening. I am sorry that my presence is required here. A slight accident, I hope? A slip and a fall? Yes, yes, yes. Carrock, indeed? Ha! Does that pain you, sir? No doubt, it does. It is the great connecting ligament here, you see, that has been badly strained. Time and rest, sir. They are often the recipe in greater cases, apostrophe with a slight sigh, and often the recipe in small. I can send a lotion to relieve you, but we must leave the cure to time and rest. Apostrophe, this he said, holding Idle's foot on his knee between his two hands, as he sat over against him. He had touched it tenderly and skillfully in explanation of what he said, and, when his careful examination was completed, softly returned it to its former horizontal position on a chair. He spoke with a little irresolution whenever he began, but afterwards fluently. He was a tall, thin, large-boned old gentleman, with an appearance at first sight of being hard-featured. But, at a second glance, the mild expression of his face, and some particular touches of sweetness and patience about his mouth, corrected this impression, and assigned his long professional rides, by day and night, in the bleak hill weather, as the true cause of that appearance. He stooped very little, though past 70 and very gray. His dress was more like that of a clergyman than a country doctor, being a plain black suit, and a plain white neckerchief tied behind like a band. His black was the worse for wear, and there were darns in his coat, and his linen was a little frayed at the hems and edges. He might have been poor, it was likely enough, in that out-of-the-way spot, or he might have been a little self-forgetful and eccentric. Anyone could have seen directly that he had neither wife nor child at home. He had a scholarly air with him, and that kind of considerate humanity towards others which claimed a gentle consideration for himself. Mr. Goodchild made this study of him while he was examining the limb, and as he laid it down, Mr. Goodchild wishes to add that he considers it a very good likeness. It came out in the course of a little conversation that Dr. Spedi was acquainted with some friends of Thomas Idle's, and had, when a young man, passed some years in Thomas Idle's birthplace on the other side of England. Certain idle labors, the fruit of Mr. Goodchild's apprenticeship, also happened to be well known to him. The lazy travelers were thus placed on a more intimate footing with the doctor than the casual circumstances of the meeting would of themselves have established. And when Dr. Spedi rose to go home, remarking that he would send his assistant with the lotion, Francis Goodchild said that was unnecessary, for, by the doctor's leave, he would accompany him, and bring it back. Having done nothing to fatigue himself for a full quarter of an hour, Francis began to fear that he was not in a state of idleness. Dr. Spedi politely assented to the proposition of Francis Goodchild, as it would give him the pleasure of enjoying a few more minutes of Mr. Goodchild's society than he could otherwise have hoped for, and they went out together into the village street. The rain had nearly ceased, the clouds had broken before a cool wind from the northeast, and stars were shining from the peaceful heights beyond them. Dr. Spedi's house was the last house in the place. Beyond it lay the moor, all dark and lonesome. The wind moaned in a low, dull, shivering manner round the little garden, like a houseless creature that knew the winter was coming. It was exceedingly wild and solitary. Roses, said the doctor, when Goodchild touched some wet leaves overhanging the stone porch, but they get cut to pieces. The doctor opened the door with a key he carried, and led the way into a low, but pretty ample hall with rooms on either side. The door of one of these stood open, and the doctor entered it, with a word of welcome to his guest. It, too, was a low room, half surgery and half parlor, with shelves of books and bottles against the walls, which were of a very dark hue. There was a fire in the grate, the night being damp and chill. Leaning against the chimney piece looking down into it, stood the doctor's assistant. A man of a most remarkable appearance. Much older than Mr. Goodchild had expected, for he was at least 52. But, that was nothing. What was startling in him was his remarkable paleness. His large black eyes, his sunken cheeks, his long and heavy iron-gray hair, his wasted hands, and even the attenuation of his figure, were at first forgotten in his extraordinary pallor. There was no vestige of color in the man. When he turned his face, Francis Goodchild started, as if a stone figure had looked round at him. Mr. Lorne, said the doctor. Mr. Goodchild. The assistant, in a distraught way, as if he had forgotten something, as if he had forgotten everything, even to his own name and himself, acknowledged the visitor's presence, and stepped further back into the shadow of the wall behind him. But, he was so pale, that his face stood out in relief against the dark wall, and really could not be hidden so. Mr. Goodchild's friend has met with accident, Lorne, said Dr. Spedi. We want the lotion for a bad sprain. My dear fellow, you are more than usually absent tonight. The lotion for a bad sprain. Yes. Directly. He was evidently relieved to turn away, and to take his white face, and his wild eyes to a table in a recess among the bottles. But, though he stood there, compounding the lotion with his back towards Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.